Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 37th episode of the Exploring Antinatalism podcast, a podcast all about the subject of antinatalism created by antinatalists. My name is Amanda Oldfan-Sukunik, also known as Forever Wolf Films on YouTube.
And I'm Mark J. Maharaj, also known as Question Mark on YouTube.
And today, we're speaking with the musician behind the recent album No Child Left Behind, accomplished antinatalist singer and songwriter A.K. Hunter.
Sky shining light, giving rise to light. The sun is a demon in the sky. Shut it off and let everything die. Leave this land barren in the light, 'cause the sun is a demon in the sky.
So, welcome to the Exploring Antinatalism podcast, Ash.
How you doing?
Pretty good. Pleasure to have you here. Let me start out by just asking a basic question about yourself. Who is A.K. Hunter?
Ash Kenneth Hunter from the northwest of England, and I'm a musician and artist, I guess, of sorts, and an antinatalist. Yeah, I mean, that's introduction.
Why are you an antinatalist?
I suppose I come from a very depressive realist kind of place, and through that kind of rationale of the world, I've ended up at antinatalism and the various areas around it, you know. So why am I an antinatalist? I don't know. I can explain how I came to it, and I don't know, yeah, because it's my beliefs, but I, you know, I came to it through reading philosophy. Looking online, you know, reading Charan and Ligotti before I'd even heard of antinatalism. And that was, you know, so through them and through online circles, the word started to appear more. So I started to look into it more.
So were you looking into like philosophical pessimism?
I'd say so, yeah. Big fan of Mark Fisher and, you know, cultural theory and stuff like that. And you know, into politics and, you know, geopolitics and stuff, state of the world, etc. So that's just something that interests me.
Ash, you are, of course, an extremely accomplished musician with an impressive touring history. Can you tell me anything about, you know, your history of making music? When did you start playing music, and how long have you been writing songs?
Since I was really little, really. I mean, my dad, he bought me my first Pearl drum kit when I was 3 years old. It was far too big for me to play, but he was a drummer, and I think that's what he wanted to do. And then when my mum remarried, moved into a house with three other siblings and just loads of musical instruments, a house full of musical instruments, so, and records and albums, and that was just kind of, it's all I've wanted to do. That's all I, you know, kind of know in that context, really. So I don't know. I guess I started my first writing songs when I was about six-ish, putting pen to paper and getting my friends over with access to a load of musical instruments, but no know-how of what to do. That was the first start of it. And then I've been in lots of bands throughout that time and performed on my own. Haven't done a lot of touring. Haven't got an actually like impressive touring history, but I did, you know, I've done a couple of bits that, you know, I'm proud of.
Well, I read that you had opened for Badly Drawn Boy, and I was very impressed by that, I have to say. I used to be like kind of obsessed with them back in the day. So that's pretty awesome. I mean, that's quite a touring history as far as I'm concerned.
A couple of years ago, he goes to Ireland kind of every now and again. So got to join him on that. It was really, you know, and that was a big thing for me because I kind of grew up on his music, and that was like a childhood dream kind of coming true, which was cool. So,
yeah, that's amazing.
When that happened.
Yeah, absolutely. How many and what instruments do you play? I know you play guitar, but do you play other instruments as well?
I mainly play guitar and harmonica, I suppose, are the main things that I play. But I can play basic drums, you know, various speeds, but I'm no good at fills or anything like that. And then, you know, kind of just have a blast at anything. I think if it makes a noise, like, you know, you can play it kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can play the tin whistle player, but I'm not going to join the Pogues anytime soon, kind of thing.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, it doesn't surprise me, actually, that you come from a musical background, a musical family. What have been your biggest musical influences?
So, a lot of, like, early folk, well, not early, like, the folk revivalists, so guitarists like Bert Jansch, Davy Graham, kind of finger-style, finger-picking guitar players, kind of, like, people like Badly Drawn Boy, Beck, Money Mark, you know, he was one of the, like, lo-fi pioneers, I think, you know. The music from like video games, like Final Fantasy VII soundtrack, Ocarina of Time soundtrack, you know, traditional country music, Hank Williams and Wayne Train. And yeah, and like more recent, especially on like No Child Left Behind, like there's quite a bit of, I suppose, more black metal influences in there as well.
Yeah.
On like vocals and tone, if you will. So yeah, really broad spectrum. Well, I don't know, on the guitar side of things, yeah, that kind of stuff, I suppose. But I like everything from, you know, hard industrial dance music to Onkyo minimalist like Music Concrete or whatever. So everything, there's something good in everything. So yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Really nice mix of stuff. What is it about antinatalism that you've found so artistically inspiring?
It's a very untapped, you know, resource of inspiration. And I think...
Absolutely.
When we, you know, obviously as an artist, you're always trying to find something new and different, and it's interesting when those philosophies kind of come, you know, a philosophy, and then you kind of go, oh, I could write some tunes about this kind of thing as well, you know, is the philosophy and the ideas that comes first, and then like, holy shit, you know, nobody's really written a great deal about this kind of thing or done it, you know, maybe in the way that I want to do it. So I think it's real open season, you know, for all artists. And but also that it's obviously, I, you know, it's something that I care about, and it was something that I could easily put my passion into. You know, it's, writing lyrics is the hardest thing to do for me. And so that No Child Left Behind EP was, that was one that was one of the easier ones. I think I, you know, probably wrote about 12 sets of lyrics for that and whittled it down to 6. So that's, you know, good, you know, that it was fun to do. That was a big part of it. It was fun. That was part of it. That was inspiring.
Yeah, it's a great album.
Putting the message out there, of course, you know, also yeah, having an activist-ish slant on it. You know, not just waffling about love or something.
I hear you. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, in my opinion, it's a stunning piece of antinatalist activism. And yeah, I agree with you completely, of course. I mean, it is an incredibly untapped world of creativity in antinatalism. And so it is kind of this this playground for artistic minds, no doubt. you talked a little bit about this already, but when do you think was the first time you heard the word antinatalism?
First time I heard it was a video by Sisyphus 55, or whether that's just Sisyphus. It was something like five most negative or pessimistic philosophies or something.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
I remember that. Spooky philosophies, I think
something,
it was.
Philosophy, something like that.
Yeah.
And I remember when I heard it, I remember exactly hearing it when I was looking out the window in the living room. And to be honest, when the first time I heard it, you know, at first, like, or his very short description of it was just kind of like, whoa, that sounds pretty hardcore, man. But obviously I was kind of on that path by looking down these philosophical avenues. And I think it is really about, yeah, I came to it then further, and then it made way more sense than just a few kind of bullet points in a spooky philosophy video, if you will.
What do you feel are the strongest arguments for antinatalism now that you've explored the topic from various angles?
I think obviously it like varies upon the individual that you're talking to, but obviously, you know, sometimes you're addressing a, you know, not just an individual when you're on the internet, for instance. I mean, the big ones for me are it's kind of creating a want without a need. I really like the kind of the Martian argument's a strong one for me. You can point to Mars and say, you know, do we mourn the non-existence of the Martians? That was something that stuck with me personally. The consent one, I'm not wild about. I get it. I understand it. But I don't know how easily it lands with someone at first, kind of, if that's the first argument you're going to use. I think that one's particularly jarring for people. But it's a weird one because I suppose I haven't been super challenged on it a lot, so I kind of muddle through it on various topics with people that I've spoken about it with. I'm not the greatest speaker. I get quite shaky and anxious when challenged. I don't know. I'm a wuss.
I guess there's a couple of ways of looking at the question that I posed there about what's the strongest arguments for being effective at communicating antinatalism versus what you personally think are strong. So like I was trying to get at what do you personally find the strongest, not, you know, what would be more convincing for everybody else?
What do I personally find?
Yeah, you personally. So it would be that Martian one, right?
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, I think that just like, the basic thing is, if I was never here, I wouldn't exist. Therefore, I wouldn't have anything to care about. So therefore, that also applies to other sentient beings. So therefore, non-existence is, I don't know, you could say it's preferential. You could say it's non-consequential. And I quite like that. So the non-existence argument, the asymmetry, I suppose, to me, is a strong one, maybe, depending on how you word it.
What are your strongest antinatalist influences? Do you read any antinatalist books, watch antinatalist videos? How do you engage with the antinatalist community?
I like to buy the magazine. You know, I've got every copy of the magazine. You know, I think that's a really great way of kind of, that's a good, I don't know, it's nice kind of solid way to read through it. I like the magazine. I read, I do have a bunch of books, you know. Shit, pardon me.
Amanda, you were actually in the Antinatalist magazine, right?
Again, issue number two, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Issue number two, got the interview with Amanda in there with pictures of her on telly and such. Ken Coates, you know, and I've got, is it, I've forgotten her name again.
Terrible. Sarah Perry?
Sarah Perry's The History of I don't have
Katerina.
Katerina Lachmaniova.
That's the one, The History of Antiochus Magog. Yeah, so I like to dip in, and I do like Choran, the kind of, I haven't read any Schopenhauer, but I do find, characters like Mainlander and, I'm sorry, my head's been...
What attracts you to Choran?
Choran?
Yeah.
It was his kind of bite-sized quote. I mean, I have, what's it called? Fuck, man. My head's drawn a blank. Sorry, The Trouble with Being Born. I've got The Trouble with Being Born. And it was interesting because there was like little sayings in there that I'd kind of thought about, and he put them into words for me, for instance, you know. That was something that of his work that I appreciated.
And how about when it comes to Antinatalist videos or
I mean, I watched, you know, I like watching the round tables, you know. I'm subscribed to plenty of people in the gang, you know. Keep up with your videos, Mark. Keep up with Amanda's videos. Glynos shows his face, you know. And basically, whenever antinatalism kind of pops up, what interests me is when it shows up in the non-antinatalist circles, if you will, or if there's... Yeah. So that really interests me, especially that when seeing how the wider world responds to it, and, you know, and that's like, I love that stuff, you know, because some people, you know, it helps with, I think, how to... best way to communicate with people. And that's something.
And how do you engage with the antinatalist community? Like, some people use Reddit, some people are more of a Discord kind of thing, and some people like to do response videos, just some examples. Curious how you like to engage with the community.
So I'm not, I started out a lot more engaging on Reddit, and Discord. I am on Discord, but I left Reddit because, and I am on some of the Facebook groups as well, but there's a crossover between the very misanthropic, shall we say, and philanthropic ideas about antinatalism sometimes on message boards and stuff. So there can be a lot of violence or just hateful language that isn't, in my opinion, useful. But I'm not a huge social media guy anyway, really.
The hateful stuff that you saw that was on Facebook, the Facebook groups?
When I say hateful, when I'm talking about like child hating, you know, parent hating, whatever, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So more of a kind of sometimes, I don't know, it might be a nihilist kind of point of view, which is latched on maybe to something in antinatalism or, you know, anti-sentience kind of, you know, sentiments. Yeah, so just certain groups I don't engage with as much. I did start trying, but I'm not much of a social media guy, and I don't take to it too much. So,
but I wanted to like highlight that one of the reasons why you wouldn't be comfortable in those particular spaces is because of the type of hatred or what's it called, misanthropy out there.
I think it's when a page, for instance, you know, can become awash with that kind of stuff. It feels like
there's no balance,
like that, or like kind of like, all right, I don't think, maybe I'm not on the same, this isn't the group that I want to hang out with, basically. You know, they might agree with the same philosophy as me, but that doesn't necessarily mean the prescriptions the same, or how you go about expressing that. So that's the, you know, but I still engage. I try to when I can.
Yeah.
As you know, Ash, anti-procreation is sometimes broken up into four general schools of thought: antinatalism, ephelism, vehement, the voluntary human extinction movement, and child-free. Can you share some of your thoughts about each of those?
Sharing as separate parts of the movement, like sharing thoughts on that kind of thing. I think they all affect picks of one another. So I mean, obviously I think you can be child free without knowing what child free is or any of the others.
Yeah.
Vehemence, an interesting one there. I mean, I am, and moving relating to ethicalism, I do agree with the kind of Benatarian antinatalist, sentiment of, applying it to all sentience. So I do agree that existence is not a good thing. It just depends how, what the prescription is really to how we go about that. So I do consider myself an antinatalist because, and rather than ethelist or vehement or anything like that, primarily, much like how maybe I could be an anarchist, utopianist kind of thing, but I'm a social democrat for the time being because I feel that's the best next step towards it, and the most kind of palatable it depends on prescriptions of each thing. I think violence will always be met with resistance, so any kind of suggestions of violence or anything I think are unhelpful. I suppose that's my thoughts on that. It's very much so, I think antinatalism is the first step, and we need to spread the word of that. And if then it's for future generations to, I believe, democratically work out among them what will, there will be future generations, I suppose, even if we're working down and down and down. So I think it's a very futuristic problem or issue to face. Although it's great to discuss it, absolutely. I don't think that discussing process or anything like that is fine. Have fun talking about it. But if we think that humans ought to do this as fast as possible, then I think the fastest possible way would be, unfortunately, probably quite slowly, but it would start with antinatalism. Yeah. I do believe.
Do you talk about this in your personal life with your friends and family?
A bit. I have friends that describe themselves as antinatalists. I have friends that have had children that I've convinced, for the time being, not to have children. I have friends that agree with my beliefs and think that they're perfectly, entitled to my beliefs, but are still trying for children or whatever. And with parents and family and stuff, I've kind of let them know, and I think I let them know before I even heard of antinatalism that there ain't going to be no grandchildren.
What's the reaction like?
I guess because they've known me so long, it's kind of like, right, well, if Ash says that's the case, he's going to do what he's going to do. So they're always good with me, parents, I'm 34 years old, I can whistle Dixie, so I explain it to them at the same time. you know, I don't need to go into deep philosophical explanations of why I should or shouldn't, and they accept it, you know.
Yeah.
It's fine, yeah. There's no beef.
Okay. Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. How does your antinatalism intersect with other social and ethical issues, such as atheism, veganism, or the right to die, or anything else that might be related?
So, I ate a vegan diet from the age of 19 till about 25, at which time, you know, I became an alcoholic and was living a very, I don't know, it's a really easy cognitively dissonant life. But when it comes to what's great is that antinatalism revitalized my vegan kind of diet, you know, and that was always a thing that I think I spoke about with people when I was vegan those years ago. People would say, well, would you rather that cows and chickens wouldn't exist than that? And I'd say, fuck yeah. You know, I'd rather cows, chickens and pigs didn't exist than be living a life of suffering, you know, in farms or whatever. So, I mean, I can easily extend that to antinatalism. And it's just, yeah, it's been a year now since I got back on a plant-based diet, and it's just good. Much, I fucking well prefer it. And compared to like 14 years ago or 10 years ago or something, like there's so much more available now, and it's actually I've heard of the word. And so makes it a bit easier to knock around, you know. Atheism, I don't think that religion has to have a huge bearing on antinatalism necessarily. But I'm an atheist.
How about the right to die?
Yeah, I mean, in a well-regulated sense, I suppose, you know, these things need working in. I don't know a whole load about it, but I mean, for instance, I did have a friend once who was kind of 18, and, you know, during her depressive kind of time, she would talk, oh, if I could I'm going to go to Switzerland and legally end my life. And, you know, now she doesn't want to do that. Would it have been better for her to legally end her life in Switzerland? I don't know, you know, but. So there's checks and balances.
What are your views on physician-assisted suicide?
Again, it's not something that I've looked into like a whole load.
Okay.
So presented every argument, so I don't just want to kind of spout something off the top of my head.
I don't want to debate you, but I was just curious, like, what are your views on it? What are your feelings on it? It's like, intuitively, are you 100% against it kind of thing, or okay exploring it with some caveats and some guidelines, or?
Absolutely happy to explore it, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, okay.
Again, I mean, if we're talking, obviously I'm 100% in favor of euthanasia, if that's the correct one, you know, if you're terminally ill or whatever, you know, the laws aren't fantastic in this country around that kind of stuff. And it's physician-assisted suicide, is this regardless of terminal physical illness?
Could not be. It depends. In Canada, they've extended it to beyond people with terminal illness. So you don't have to be terminal to apply.
Okay. But yeah, every death has an impact in one way or another. So, I mean, I guess it's a case of working out, you know, yeah, weighing up in each individual case.
Do you think death is a harm?
No. I think it can be, you know, it has consequences that you know, of who knows, kind of unmeasurable, you know, whether those consequences are good or bad for the living. They have consequences. I know that's kind of vague.
What about consequences for the individual? Did you read Benatar's Human Predicament?
I didn't, no.
No. So there's some that argue that I'm gonna botch the argument, but that you deprive a person of all of the good things that can happen in the future, and that in and of itself is a harm to the individual. Now, of course, you prevent a lot of bads, but that still doesn't take away that there's still harms, right? And we have an interest for our for the continuation of our consciousness, our identity. So the annihilation of our identity is can also be seen as a harm. So I was just curious, because like some people see death as, for the person, could be neutral, right? There's nobody there, who could be harmed? Some people see it as a deprivation, some people see it as a good. So I was just curious, yeah, how do you view death for the individual, and as you were mentioning, consequences to others?
The individual, like, sadly to say or whatever, like personally, I know, you know, if I die, my belief is that I don't care, because I haven't got the facility to care, the faculty to care. So my death is of zero consequence to me, if you will. Does that make sense?
Yep.
It
sounds like Epicurean, yeah.
So yeah, that's how I feel about death on a personal level. But obviously, you know, I don't walk into the road with my eyes closed, because there are people that care about me, and I do care about them, and meaning and value or whatever comes from existence, I suppose. So I hold on to my existence, as most of us try to, I suppose.
Would antinatalism intersect, because you mentioned Mark Fisher as well, would there be a type of intersection between his analysis and antinatalism?
Well, I think me and Amanda, we recently were looking at a blog post from Mark Fisher's K-Punk site. I think it was, didn't it predate Benatar? His post called Anti-Natal.
Yeah, it wasn't quite antinatalism, but I think it was in 2004, if I'm not mistaken. So yeah, good period of time before Benatar.
I mean, I think he talks about one of his things that he mentions is, you know, immigration could solve that, which, sorry, anyway, I digress. With regards to how it relates to Mark Fisher, I mean, I think he kind of had a very pessimistic view of where the world was going. So I suppose really it linked on from his cultural critique and, you know, the direction that we were headed in, you know. So any kind of people, Chomsky, you know, for instance, they paint far too strong a picture of a bad future for me. So I guess that's a big part of how people like Fisher, you know, a lot of depressive realism in there, I think.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's a shame that his antinatalism was essentially censored too when they, you know, compiled his work. So
right, they didn't include it in the K-Punk book. I mean, he did make a lot of posts, but yeah. I mean, at the same time, I disagree with him about certain things, because the next post on from the antenatal one is talking about how, you know, cannabis is for deadheads kind of thing, you know, and I'm a pot smoker.
So. Yeah. Yeah. So, Ash, the first time I ever heard about you, I do believe, was April 24th, 2020, when you released your entry into my contest, the 6th annual Why Are You an Antinatalist contest. I can't believe that that's a little over a year ago. It seems like so long ago. What made you decide to make a video for the contest this year, that year?
It was kind of around the start of the whole COVID, well, starting the UK of the COVID pandemic anyway, yeah. When we take it seriously. And I'd got into kind of streaming and video making and stuff, you know, happened around that time, doing stuff for the label that I work with. And when I kind of found the competition and I don't know, I just thought this is like it was the first community that I'd seen that like I felt like, oh, I can engage in this and feel comfortable engaging in it. And because it was kind of small, it felt like a welcoming place, I guess, you know. So I felt like I could express my views like online for the first time and just feel pretty solid about them, you know. I mean, there's a million veganism videos out there, there's a million antinatalism videos out there, but you know, or there's 1,000 or something.
Yeah, know?
There's a lot, but it was, yeah, I just, you know, I guess I felt like for the first time, like I wanted to be part of a community. So that's something that I hadn't done before. You know, I could just sat at the sidelines or whatever, but thought cool to get involved because I got lots of ideas and stuff. Made the little, it's on my phone, which I'm using at the moment, but the patches and stuff. So I was just glad to be,
yeah,
you know, do something, you know, really, to be honest. It sounds like a bit like vanity wise or whatever, but it was, you know, I think having a community that you feel comfortable in does help progress ideas and, you know, create discussion. Hey.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I'm glad it made you feel that way. Yeah, that you did absolutely donate some patches to that year's contest, and I want to thank you again for that. And I'll be announcing the contest for this year very, very soon. So yeah, thank you again for your submission. When you first began your channel, as you just said, you were doing some live streams at the time, a couple of them featuring, you know, various older antinatalist content that you had found and that you'd really liked, which was really awesome, you know, because there's a lot of content gets produced, but it doesn't really get seen past a certain point. So I loved that idea. So, can you tell me a little bit more about these live streams that you were doing? And do you think you have any, you know, plans in the future to do more of them?
I don't know. So that was great for me because that was on World AN Day last year, I think.
Was it? Yeah, I think you're right, actually. Yeah.
Like a 6-hour stream or 4 hours or something like that. And I was just kind of going through a bunch of stuff that I hadn't seen before or that I thought was, you know, good to show. But I was really into live streaming at the time. The bug has evaporated a little. I think I probably overdid it. but who knows? You know, potentially.
Cool.
So it's just something that I was really enthusiastic about at the time. My enthusiasm goes up and down.
That's fair enough. It's fair enough. you have 2 YouTube channels, 3 actually. It seems one of them is sort of auto-generated, if I'm not mistaken, which is actually kind of cool. Why have you decided? Oh, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh no, I think like that's through the record label and stuff like that.
Okay. Okay.
It's not. I don't have any control over that stuff.
Oh no, I didn't assume so. What I just was curious what your decision was to sort of split your material into 2 different channels was. I mean, there is a different. The music you're producing on each is quite different in many respects. But I just was, you know, curious to ask you that.
I suppose because I did start it off as a specifically antinatalist channel, that probably doesn't cross over greatly with kind of the middle class boomer audience that most of my music seems to be appreciated by, or children on the other channel, you know.
Yeah, I can understand that.
I kept them separate, and then I decided to start doing the music, because I think I originally called the channel like ANFLism or something like that, and then I changed it to AK Hunter because I started doing the music thing.
Yeah.
Or no. So I kept them separate, and interest. You know, I mean, to be fair, like my antinatalism channel's got a lot more subscribers than my other one.
Yeah.
You know. I don't have millions, but I have hundreds, but but bringing them together at some point, I definitely think I will be able to, you know, because a lot of the people that I show, for instance, the video of the sun app of, you know, the sun, most people, all the antinatalist stuff goes completely over their heads anyway. They're just like, oh, cool.
Little yeah.
You know, whatever. So I think unless you're really looking at it, paying attention to it close, then, yeah, I haven't received any kind of, you think it's okay to, you don't think procreation's moral kind of thing? You know, I haven't received that from anyone on the non-antinatalist side yet. So, and, it's a slow, it's all marketing.
I hear you. Well, no, I mean, it makes sense. I'm glad you haven't had pushback. That's good. So now, Ash, I'd love to talk to you in more detail about your various musical projects, all of your various albums. Your sound has a number of different eras, and you're quite brilliant at weaving in and out of different styles. That's one of the many things that I find so impressive about your work, and it's been a true pleasure doing the research for this episode and getting to sample, you know, all the work that you've done. You've got so many different albums and just so many different flavors of what you produce. So I wanted to ask you a little bit first off about Diary of a Caretaker, which if I'm not mistaken is from 2010. Really love this album. I know some of the content kind of ended up on later albums. What was it that inspired this album, and was this technically your first album?
I think it was it was my first acoustic album that I'd done purely like, you know, vocals, full length songs, stuff like that. But I was a caretaker at a cinema. That's why it's called Diary of a Caretaker. And I pretty much wrote most of those songs just whilst, you know, humming to myself and recording little notes into my Sony Ericsson and go home and kind of transpose it onto guitar or whatever. So, but yeah, just drinking, smoking, living the rural life, small town life, you know. And kind of trying to put words to something. But I think it was because I'd written a song, the first track on that album, someone was like, oh wow, this actually sounds like real music, Ash, sounds like something people would buy. So kind of cracked on with it, and good stuff, you know, kind of came from working through that, you know.
Yeah,
it was, as well, it was fun, you know. Wrote most of that just kind of sat at a window looking out over the local main street. So yeah, recorded it at home.
Yeah, I love that. The whole album has a great feel to it. Were you already playing live quite a lot by this point?
Yeah, I've been playing live since I used to play like parties and kids parties like when I was a kid, not when I was older.
Yeah.
And then yeah, I'd played open mic nights, gigs, all sorts. I'd also been in a band. We had a record out on some independent record label, so I'd been, you know, playing a lot with the band, performed live, so a long time. Yeah, before then.
You were already quite seasoned by that point, for sure. Is it around this point that you started to, that you got signed by Moulin Rouge Records?
It was a few years later. I, you know, again, like I was drifting drinking far too much and ended up in Australia for a bit. Then, you know, trying to work and stuff, and then came back and thought, like, give the music thing a proper go. And fun, like, Badly Drawn Boy was spotted in my local town. Turns out he was out celebrating the birthday of his producer. And so I was hanging out with them and eventually just kind of bumped into him again in town, the producer Colin, and said, oh, can I give you a CD? And he happened to be looking for artists at the time and he liked it. So just kind of one of those lucky things where he was just like, if I hadn't stopped and caught that bloke, like when I caught him, it was his leaving party to move up to Scotland, you know. So if I hadn't decided to stop him, then it would have been different. So those little right place, right time jobbies.
Exactly. Perfect. Perfect place. Perfect time. What did you say? I'm sorry.
With a bit of preparation.
Right. Well, that's amazing. So I might be kind of getting some of the chronology out of whack, and I do apologize if I am. But as far as I know, then came the absolutely gorgeous album Rural Music, which I absolutely love. I've listened to it quite a few times now at this point. Please tell me about, you know, how this album came to be. What was it that inspired, you know, Rural Music?
I'm surprised that's really your bag, to be honest. It's such a hopeful, optimistic record.
Oh, I love all kinds of music. You know, it doesn't have to be dark and grim for me to love it. I love a lot of whimsical, nostalgic work.
To be, I love dark and miserable music. So. It's rural music because it was written in like say a little rural little England town, and to be honest, like my perception of the world was very much a little Englander kind of view, so it really kind of sings about and talks about and has that feeling of cozy, everything's okay. You know, it's mostly songs about their hometown where I live though, really. But you go to any small town in England and they're all the same, you know, small communities of people and small pub culture and local festivals, things like that. Just, yeah, so a lot of dreaming of the magical non-existent life that no one ever has, except for me in the Cotswolds or something, probably. Something like that. So, but yeah, just a kind of folky, you know, it was mainly about the guitar and the songwriting for me, though. That was, that's always the production, all that stuff wasn't something that I, you know, not that I didn't have a hand in it or couldn't have a hand in it. It was just, I'm like, oh, I'll leave that stuff to you guys. You've got the connections there, you know, they knew. And yeah, so, and one of the tracks got on a movie, Eaten by Lions. Got the opening track on that. So I'm stoked, like, just for that kind of commercial success. Because is that kind of commercial, you know, it's a commercial world when it comes to that stuff, and it is nice, you know, kind of non-offensive music, not exactly going to challenge many things, but you know, it still has its place and people enjoy it, and it's, you know, nice music, it's good. I'm proud of it.
I'm glad to hear that. You should be proud of it. That was George and the Dragon that was in the movie Eaten by Lions, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that title can kind of give an allusion to the, you know, kind of Little Englander kind of thing, you know, a lot of it is based on childhood stories and stuff like that as well. Read as a kid, you know, that kind of, yeah. Molly and Damien went to the farm and they, or Mr. Ben and shit like that, you know, children's shows that I grew up on.
Yeah.
That little, like, magical cartoonish view of the world, definitely.
No, I hear you. Well, I mean, I was going to talk about this later, but I mean, there's something that I sort of work with in my own stuff too, my own art, you know, antinatalist art, you know, mixed with all the other kinds of art that I do. And like, there's a certain tension in your work that I think is, you know, I relate to a lot. I kind of label it this tension of between archivist and extinctionist. So it's like, okay. I love to sort of like archive the things about life that I love and pay homage to them. Like, you know, I a lot of the other stuff I do that, but I'm also an extinctionist. So it's like, it's very strange to sort of have this tension in one's work of like, you know, holding up high these things about life that we love, yet also while having this diagnosis of life that is so bleak. So I've always sort of, you know, having seen like a much wider spectrum of your work now, it's something that I kind of can identify with in my own practice. And I think you do, I think you hold that tension very, very well and very interestingly. And I think, you know, are able to fluctuate between them in a really interesting way. And I think you are a great lyricist and a great storyteller, and it's clear that you're sort of telling the story of your childhood. And I really love that about your work.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's also very present in Haunts as well, right? It's sort of like all this nostalgia, this whimsy, this love of England. It's a love letter, really. A lot of the I think both of those albums is that a fair assessment to the things that you love.
Ah, but also like there was kind of a miniature jive on kind of capitalist culture as well.
Sure, sure.
I suppose I was watching the main thing that led to that EP is I was obsessed with Dan Bell. He does a series called the Dead Mall series on YouTube. So I think I spent about a year watching those and kind of compiling my feelings and. But yeah, that in a way, that's more of an Americana sort of nostalgia. You know, there's a song about The Shining on there, bowling. And then obviously, like the song 100 Years, of course, talks about the, you know, last line is, will we even be here in 100 years? So I was already kind of thinking very, you know, in that kind of long term way, not just nostalgia as well. That's where I'm starting to think about more things like that.
Yeah. What was, aside from, you know, the obvious success of like having a song included in the film and everything, what's been the general response to that album? And what's some of the other, you know, pieces of attention that it's received?
When it's had attention, people, you know, the people that are into that kind of stuff like it, but it's such a saturated market. It's a very competitive market. There's a lot of doing that kind of thing. And you know, I think what I do in that field is more interesting personally than what a lot of people are doing out there, but that's my opinion. So the response, very tiny but positive.
Okay, yeah.
7 years, but you know, I'm not, yeah, you know, it's there, and that's the thing. I made it, it's there, it's done to me. What comes of it in the future is I'm not a marketer, I'm not a businessman.
I hear you.
I know you're meant to be like that these days, but
it's a hard coat to wear. I don't wear it so easily myself. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I'm not a classical musician, so I don't write classical music, so I'm not a businessman, so I'm not going to do business work, but I'm a guitarist, I'll do that.
And you do that very well. I wanted to point out the song Grand England had a music video, which was totally hand-drawn by you. Beautiful music video. Had you ever done animation previous to this? I mean, I was so elated to find it because, you know, of course, I saw The Sun, and then I was like, oh, no, he has done something like this sort of before. So, yeah, do you like to animate? Is that something that you want to do more of?
I think it's wicked. It's great fun. And I really love the technology that's available now. I think the first time I had a go at animation was when I was about 10 years old, and I used like a Sony Handycam, like record stop kind of thing. It was like Wallace and Gromit was really popular. I don't know whether you heard.
Yeah, definitely.
So Nick Park the guy that created it had a studio over in Altrincham, which is just the town over. So it was like, oh, wow, local guy, you know, like, that was something that I was into. But no, and then this animatic, the idea of doing an animatic came up. Like, I thought that was kind of a fun way to introduce yourself to it.
Yeah.
I think. But yeah, technology is just so wicked now. Like, it's amazing. And that's what's fun coming into making videos or animations or anything like that. Because I remember when I first wanted to do animation, me and my dad went around Manchester, old shops looking for old cine cameras. Then you'd have to look for old film and then you'd have to send it off developed. And like, if I had to do that, the sum would have taken me years because I fucked it up that many times. But you can see you're fucking it up, at least. So, yeah, I think it's brilliant and, yeah, really good fun. I just wish I'd made it bigger. It's so tiny.
Well, I sat on the rocks and I watched the sky, and the gulls cried out as they flew by. I lay in the shade while the sun was high and listened to the sound of the rolling tide.
Is that you as a kid on the front cover?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought, yeah.
Isn't Milk brilliant from a British TV show called The Fast Show at the time?
Oh, okay.
Paul Whitehouse and a bunch of others.
Yeah, okay. Where's the best place to find this album? At the minute, it seems like it's only available on that, you know, one channel. Are there places where people can buy the album? Are there any physical copies available?
Yeah, it's available on Spotify. We're talking about Rural Music and Haunts.
Rural Music, yeah, and Haunts, and yeah.
They're on Spotify and iTunes and all that stuff.
Okay.
And then there's my nest egg of goddamn how many fucking Rural Music CDs sat outside on the landing. So call me anytime.
Yeah, I'll buy one. You got it. Absolutely. I'd love to have one. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about Nature of Hell, which is, as far as I'm aware, was your next musical project, a totally different tone to Rural Music, much darker. I think in some respects, it's sort of a halfway point, kind of, to Rural Music and the content that I was first introduced to you as. So you, as far as I know, I think you produced three albums with Nature of Hell. Anthropocy, am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, that's my poor translation of Anthropocene.
Oh, Anthropocene. Okay, yeah. Okay, I get you. Beneath and Chasm, and you also produced at least one music video for this project, Blood Red Rug. Absolutely love some of the similarities between that video and The Sun, which, you know, starting the record player, getting the coffee. I love that. Yeah. what can you tell me about Nature of Hell?
The project that I started with, a lady, she's in her 60s, met her at an open mic night. And, she just writes lyrics and I arrange music. That's the main thing, really. I think I've written a couple of vocals for that project, but none of the vocals are mine other than a few tracks. But really, it's a kind of just a fun side project I learned a lot about production, music production, recording and stuff like that just at home. So it's been really valuable in that sense. And just, it's good to make music with somebody who's enthusiastic. We did two more albums as well that are yet to be released. They're not complete. But those will be the last ones of that project. So yeah, I mean, that's just something, a way to kind of try and get the darker, heavier music out, just a good opportunity for me to do that, because she's an old rocker into Status Quo and fucking Scorpions and shit, so.
Yeah.
It's black metal stuff.
Yeah.
I don't care, we're doing it anyway.
Well, I really enjoyed those albums for sure. So unfortunately that project is ongoing, yeah. But towards the end of its life cycle.
Yeah, we've done live performances, kind of like home live performances, you know. Okay. Each time we release an album, obviously the last couple of years or whatever have been real fucky. But yeah, we don't, not really something that perform live. It's hard to perform live, really, because there's only the two of us, and I'm playing like 6 or 7 instruments on each song. So,
oof, yeah,
we're a way to do that, and it, you know, sometimes, but it's fun putting together our little shows, you know, with friends and stuff. Yeah, so. Just good fun, and that's the main part of it, really.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, it seems like it's been a very fruitful, you know, collaboration while it's going on.
No, we got absolutely a lot of work done, indeed, you know.
Yeah, I love it. Is Nature of Hell also sort of your own personal, I don't know what word to attach to it, label? Or like, I've noticed some of your other content, you're like a Nature of Hell production or something of that nature.
I like the term, I came up with the name and I like it.
Yeah, it sounds good.
Use that as another thing, like, you know, sounds good. So, yeah, no, no, not like an official production company or anything like that, or a publishing right. company.
Well, before we go on to discuss some of the AK Hunter material, the material that was later on the other album, can you tell me a little bit about Soaking with Paul? Because I really loved both of those albums, but I'm just curious Paul. About those. Yeah,
that's my favorite work.
Really?
That was with a guitarist that I've been friends with since we met in high school, and we're in various bands together and stuff. And developing that kind of Hawaiian guitar sound, and then really slowing it down. So kind of applying the techniques of DJ Screw. I'm a big fan of like Chopped and Screwed hip hop. And then vapor waves appeared and stuff. So kind of squishing it all together in a way, you know, and with the whole climate change vibe, I like that. It's like music for the end of the world as everybody melting. I call it heat or melt music. So yeah, I love Hawaiian music. I love all that kind of pedal steel slide guitar, anything like that. And then when that sound is melted and I don't know. I really like that. And yeah, so I'm glad you mentioned it.
Yeah. So melt wave as opposed to vapor wave then. Is it?
Wave.
What? Sorry, say again?
Heat wave.
Oh, heat wave. There you go. Okay. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, it's got a very like surf kind of quality to it. And then it's, yeah.
I mean, there is two of them. And one of them's like performances that we actually did. And then another one, the second tracks that I'd taken and mixed up with a whole bunch of like weather reports and like antidepressant adverts and stuff like that.
Yeah,
but I'm really pleased with that. I listened to it probably. Yeah, I'm probably the reason it has 40 views.
I've listened to it a couple of times myself, so I'm in there somewhere. So I wanted to actually, I think this is kind of a good segue, but yeah. So I think when we first started communicating, I think you had just put out 4 Years Somber in 2018. Maybe it was actually later than that. It had to have been later than that. Never mind. Yeah. But anyway, I think that was the first thing that you had sent me. That's probably where my memory is going. This is a great album. I mean, it's mostly instrumental, very dark, very beautiful. And was this, am I correct in thinking this was sort of your first album that was in some way directly inspired by antinatalism?
I'm afraid not. It was kind of recorded over a period between 2016 and 2018. You know, there's a very depressive tone to it, which was something started expressing more around that time. A lot of that was based off, and you know, I'm big into like 80s, 70s horror flicks. So a lot of that was based off the soundtracks from that kind of. So I'm sorry to disappoint, unfortunately.
No, not at all, not at all. It was my misinterpretation of the material. But yeah, I can hear the sort of 80s horror soundtrack kind of influence in there for sure. Yeah.
That's, I mean, some people have taken it and taken their own antinatal, you know, musings from it because it's on an antinatalist channel, and that's great. You know, I mean, obviously, songs about suicide, a song about suicide in there, you know. So
what have people done with it? Have people used it in various places? Or
I know that someone, one chap, he wrote a short story and put a link to it, you know, kind of saying, oh, this track inspired this short antinatalist writing, you know. So okay. That was nice.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So yeah, not like piles of letters through the door, but
well, it's a great album. There'll be a link to it below, and yeah, everybody should go check that out. So let's talk a little bit about No Child Left Behind, which was your latest album, released just last year, 2020, a full-on antinatalist album, I think it's safe to say, for this one. It's quite an achievement, 8 gorgeous tracks, all inspired by antinatalism. When did you first start working on this album, and what was the primary, you know, catalyst inspiration for this particular one?
I think when I started working on it, I can't think when I started working on it. It probably took me about 8 months or something like that, you know, roughly, maybe a bit longer, because I did stop and work on the Sun video for a portion of time. But again, like I was saying, like, because it was quite it was such an inspiring topic to me, I did actually produce it far quicker than most of the work that I do come out with, you know. I'm hoping that certain parts of it weren't rushed, but you know, I'm pleased with it. I'm happy with, you know, putting it out there, and as well, I produced it myself, so it's nice how response, you know, I had a great response, so I'm pleased.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. As I've told you before, my favorite song on the album is "I Forgive You." Just fantastic lyrics. I want I find your approach to antinatalism very warm. This song is a great example of that. I think you aren't, you know, hateful in any of your music or lyrics. You're sort of trying to find a resolution, this kind of resolution between parent and child, this understanding, this compassion. And it speaks to this idea that I'm always thinking about it a lot, where, like, you know, I think antinatalism is going to be sort of a fixture of the modern family moving forward as this idea, you know, grows and spreads more. It's going to have to become something that people in families talk about and have to, you know, still be a family at the end of the day, you know, if that's possible. Sorry, go ahead.
Or in China right now, where they just introduced the 3-child policy.
Yeah. I was reading about that earlier today, yeah.
But most people still stick to 2 anyway, or 1, or even none. So.
Yeah.
That's okay, but sorry, I digressed.
No, it's okay. But yeah, I really appreciate that. I think it's a style, it's an attitude, it's an engagement with non-antinatalists. I think that's going to be very important. I think that song is just sort of a piece of that kind of attitude that I think is valuable. So is there anything else you can tell me about that song, or what, you know, what directly inspired it?
Well, it's talking about that kind of stuff. It's non-suffering, isn't it? So it's the reduction of a reduction of suffering, I think, can really come through understanding. So when we, you know, do talk about that kind of stuff, I mean, like, I don't blame the poor for being poor kind of thing. So I don't, I'm not so, you know, we're all victims of society in one way or another. And unless we're enlightened to information, then, you know, I suppose it's that kind of attitude. Yeah. Just a bleeding heart lefty.
Wanted to ask a little bit about Mouse Poem. It was my great honor to have my horrible accordion playing included in this track. It's really a deeply disturbing track that really, you know, stands in stark contrast to a lot of your older work, especially because it's a darker vision of your childhood as opposed to sort of something like Rural Music, which is a much lighter, you know, impression of your childhood, particularly in how it describes some of your early, you know, traumatic experiences with animal suffering. Can you tell me a little bit about this piece?
Well, yeah, I mean, interesting that you say that it's different from Rural Music, because there's a song called The Motorway on Rural Music, which is about riding my dad. He was a driver, wagon driver, and he used to take chickens to battery farms. So the song The Motorway was originally about that. Obviously, I don't get into specifics on that. So it's more of an expansion on that. So it's like, oh, this beautiful trip down the motorway and all the great memories that I have on that. And then the reality of it was, yeah, that we were going to a battery farm and, chucking the dead ones away. I can't believe what I was seeing. Yeah, 6 years old, I cried my eyes out. A titty, you know, calendar or something in his cab, so he just told me to go and look at the tits. So that's probably developed, you know, in some interesting way. But yeah, that was, you know, I went and looked into a battery farm at age 6, and all I say was a torch. It was infinite death.
Yeah.
But, you know, I obviously didn't draw the correlation between the food and all that when I was a kid, you know. Or it was just told to me that that's the way it is.
Yeah.
And yeah, you at the behest of adults' opinions and beliefs, of course, when you're a kid. So.
Yeah, but that would.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, I had a pet mouse, and yeah, I had gave birth to a litter and ate them all, and then scratched all the fur off and was bleeding and that. So my mum had to put it to sleep, but. She was the euthanizer in our household because she used to worked at a vet at some point. So she's very familiar with animal death or putting them out of their misery, as it was always put to me growing up. Yeah, and then the last like little stanza talks about kind of homelessness. So yeah, again, like my first trip to London as a kid, I didn't understand why there were people, and like there was a lot of homeless people in London at that time. I think Manchester's probably worse now. But, yeah, they're just those facing those realities and then being told that's just the way it is, basically. That's what that poem's about.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really, really powerful track.
Accordion. That's
spot on. Well, thank you again for using it. That was really a highlight of my year, if not life, to have an actual musician like my accordion playing. My hand is too fucked up now to do it, so it's I'm glad it got preserved a little bit there. Do you have any plans to publish any of the lyrics anywhere? Your music, actually.
The lyrics are all published of. No Child Left Behind. I put them in the comments, the top comment of the video.
Oh, okay.
Someone asked me to, so I was like, oh. As for other stuff, I don't think I have, but I always try and sing as clearly and audibly as possible so that everybody can understand my words. I think that's the thing for me, like it, I mean, and maybe I'm doing myself in here it annoys me when I can't understand what people are saying most of the time, so I guess I don't know, I don't think there's other lyrics stuff posted anywhere.
Okay, that's fair enough. I mean, you and I have talked about this in the past, but any chance that there will be physical copies of No Child Left Behind at some point, or and anywhere where people can go, you know, pay to download the album as opposed to getting it for free on YouTube?
It's just for free on YouTube at the moment. It's something I think I will get around to. And the more interest there is, I think that's it. Because I'm not interested about making money out of it. Breaking even would be nice, but I do, you know, I want it to be fairly, you know, worth it. I don't want to bust off a bunch of copies and then no interest. So, I do want to, possibly if this podcast gets me some more attention, you shall see.
Absolutely. Well, I hope that can happen at some point. Do you think that, like, obviously I know COVID's been in everybody's way this last year, but once things open back up again, do you plan on, you know, playing that album live, or, you know, going around with it?
And can pay for the train ticket and I've got somewhere to stay. If it's far to go, then yeah, sure. I've not got a big income, so I can't afford to kind of travel around off my own pocket, unfortunately. But I am happy to play, like, if people want me to. That makes me happy. But yeah.
Sweet. I hope you get the chance to do that for sure.
Yeah, no. Be good. I mean, like, and hopefully, yeah, with more anti-natalist meetings coming up, you know.
Yeah.
That's something that'd be cool. I'd be happy to. You know, if that's something that people are interested in.
Sweet. Well, one of the tracks on No Child Left Behind is The Sun, which on its own is brilliant, but has the added distinction of having been given a hand animated stop motion animated music video, a painstakingly animated music video created entirely by yourself. And it's astounding, filled with references to all kinds of anti-natalist things from the past that you've put in there. But first off, what inspired the song The Sun?
Fucking hot weather, man. Like today. I think I was just melting and just looked and said, the sun is a fucking demon in the sky. So that's how I write a lot of my songs. Usually just a little thing pops into my head and I can go from there. So that was the initial thing. And then, of course, you know, I was thinking a lot along those anti-natalist lines, and it was just perfect.
Yeah.
So, and again, it's kind of, it's not so, it is blunt, but somehow people miss the bluntness if they're not looking for it. So it kind of works out. I don't know, or maybe that's just my perception.
No, I think you're right. It's one of those pieces that kind of, like, it's pretty explicit in what it's about, but at the same time, it has enough, like, I don't know, poetry is not quite the right word, but it kind of just has that ability to be perceived in other ways.
Behind it.
What did you say?
Nice, got a nice twinkly guitar behind it. So people go, ooh, twinkly guitar.
Yeah, I think that's probably definitely part of it, yeah. How long did the video take to make?
I think it was about, I think I said 6 months before, but about 4 months, bits of breaks. It was over the lockdown. There were times where I needed help. And so, but yeah, probably 4 months-ish, something like that.
Okay. And I've always wondered, how big was this set? And did any of it survive the creation of the video?
It all survived. I still keep the bits if you want to see some of the bits.
Yeah, definitely.
Grab a couple of things here. So here's, this is from the last shot. But as you can see, it's absolutely tiny.
It's so tiny. There he is.
There he is. And
it's beautiful. Yeah,
I had to remake like the aperture for it because there was no proper aperture I could get big enough. Where's the camera? I'm sorry,
it's okay.
So,
he looks great
already on that. And then some of the set here, you can see how kind of tiny that pack of Marlboros that he was.
Yeah.
And I basically, took a bunch of those little flickering candles, and that's kind of, ripped the wiring out of them to make the lights and stuff.
So awesome. Is it clay mostly, or what's it made out of?
Clay and cardboard.
Clay and cardboard, okay.
We've got your little magazines and records.
Yeah, look at that. That's one of my favorite parts of the whole video is these little, so there's magazine number 4 and they're soaking with Paul and
little mini references. I like those kind of Easter eggs in
stuff
that I wanted to put a lot of that in there myself.
I love it. Did you
I'd make it probably that big rather than that big.
Mm.
Probably twice as big.
Yeah, that probably would have been a little easier on you, right, to have to manipulate,
But, to be fair, I was in a really small space anyway. I've just got a little room here that I work from.
Yeah. Amazing. I mean, when you were building it, did you take any, like, process photos or process videos? Do you think we'll ever get to see some of that?
I did plan and still do plan on kind of, hopefully, maybe before this is out, I'd like to, I don't know how long the gap is, but put out a bunch of, individual videos for each track as well. But for the Sun, I'd like to just kind of, show all the process photos as a kind of little behind the scenes video.
I'd love that.
But yeah, a lot of that stuff, like the set design and that was taken a lot, I was hugely inspired by all your sets for the F-List and stuff.
Thank you.
Which just, I love that style where as long as there's the effort in it, it shows and it looks great. If you half-ass something, then it doesn't look good. But as long as you put the effort in and it's strong, it looks good, I think. And so a lot of that, your work ethic or whatever it is, I hope that sounds okay, I love the style and showed me that I could do that myself.
thank you, Ash. That means a lot to me to hear. And yeah, thank you for including part of the F-List in the video. That was I was hugely honored to be included in that. I of course agree. I love that. I just love that sort of like that style of taking whatever's around you and just, not putting a lot of money into it or anything, just sort of, getting it done and putting all the passion into it. And that's the best style for me. Yeah.
Absolutely. Love and passion.
Yeah, exactly. Just want to ask you a little bit about what your thoughts are about this world that this character exists in. Like, obviously it's a room, but in your mind, what is the narrative there? Like, is he trapped there? And is he sort of in the midst of full on extinction and he's sort of all that's left, or, what is the story behind it?
So, I think originally I wanted to animate it, but I just found it a bit too hard. He's the caretaker. He's the caretaker of the planet, kind of thing. So, your caretaker. So the idea was that when he enters the room, he takes off that mask and just reveals that he has no mask.
Okay.
But I guess the no face is sort of similar to the mask that you wore.
Yeah.
But could just be received on different levels, he watches the F-List and his whole world changes. So that it's about perception or it can be just about that, living in a dank, shitty, dark place. So it looks cool and I'd live there, but that just, who knows where he lives, but he's the caretaker. And Ethelism is, or the film, The Ethelist, certainly has a very big impact on it. So yeah, I don't know. It was just a bunch of ideas that I really wanted to throw together. And I kind of made it up as I went along, to be honest. Which is probably
fair enough.
Animation.
Yes.
But I think I decided the ending halfway through making it. So I was lucky that I didn't have to reshoot loads of things like that. So, but I had a loose idea.
No, I love that. I mean, I hadn't realized that there was, you know, he's maybe sort of the janitor, like without the mask or something. That's an awesome idea. Like that's what he comes home to essentially. Yeah.
Was an extension of that character in a sense. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's awesome. Well, thank you, Ash. Thank you so much. And yeah, there's like a loss to what happens to him, and it's kind of sad in one sense, but he just seems so happy. I mean, he just goes to sleep, you know. It's very peaceful. There's that lack of it's all very dark, but there's none of that like misanthropy kind of to it, like we were talking about before. You know?
Very cool story.
Yeah.
If you will. Just a lot about peace and ending of suffering, really. That's the just such a big thrust of antinatalism to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I highly encourage everybody to go watch The Sun and listen to all of your albums, but what?
Oh, I was just sentiment to the audience.
Do it. Yes, definitely go listen to No Child Left Behind. We just have just a few other sort of questions and comments about all the stuff that you've done. So I talked a little bit about the tension in your work and how much I sort of identify with that. I guess you spoke a little bit about this previously, but were people that are familiar with sort of your older work, were they a little bit taken aback by this, or it's pretty much flown under the radar, so to speak, as far as what's behind it, perhaps?
I mean, people I know who know my music, and that's the main, you know, where I hear feedback from.
Yeah.
They'll think it's wicked, you know? I mean, I don't know, like, they're focusing on the topics, but they're happy to hear new music from me. I don't know. They like the kind of thing that I do. I haven't played it to people that say very Puritan people that enjoy my music, for instance, certain family members and people. I think it might scare them a bit. So, but that's just a personal relation thing, kind of thing. You know, I don't want to make my sister with three kids cry as much as my life a bit easier.
I hear you. Yeah. All right. Well, I just wanted to ask you some sort of more questions about antinatalist music. So like me, we've talked a little bit about previously, you and I, that you also collect antinatalist music. And just wanted to know, what are some of your favorite pieces, you know, of antinatalist music that have been produced other than your own so far?
So when I say I've been collecting, I've been compiling it. I don't have a physical, I'm not a big physical collector of music just simply because of space issues. Like I do have lots of records and CDs, but I had to stop buying them just for space issues. But with regards to antinatalist artists, obviously Maestro, you know, yeah. I think he's, when it comes to the rap side of things, a lot of good stuff out there. British artist recently popped up. Should if I get my this book, Holotrop, like Holotrop, and they jumped the gun on me using the Dinosauria Wee poem by Charles Bukowski at the Open. It's the Born Into This.
Oh, yes, yes. That was a beautiful track. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a poem by Charles Bukowski. The only change I'd be born out of this. So, yeah, I love that because I'm a fan of kind of ambient and sound art, things like that. Chris Corder, is it? Got some interesting stuff. Obviously, there's a plethora of black metal out there. fan of, you know, that kind of raw black metal and depressive suicidal black metal, those kind of styles. So it, I mean, I've been looking for a while, and yeah, a lot of stuff, a lot of rap, and a lot of vocally inaudible.
Yes, that's true.
Then just certain, you know, I'm trying to think of tracks out there. There was a question that the song Kids by MGMT had antinatalist themes. That was a big pop tune 20 years ago or something. Or even Kareem McCormick. Yeah, I've been building this list. Yeah. I've been putting together a playlist for a Resonance FM, which is a London-based radio station of antinatalist music. So if you do have any antinatalist music, please do send me your links to ash@familyhunter.co.uk, because I need more. You know, Cosmic Slam, still grinding on. So he's really coming up with some of the stuff he sent me recently is great. Really love his bass and guitar work's really coming on.
Yeah, he's very talented.
Like a bunch of his older stuff as well, especially the really atmospheric stuff. Obviously, you know, sad to see Creep go.
Yeah,
you
know, it's a big tragedy.
Somebody that I think could have really, you know, had some potential, you know, because the avant-garde kind of edges of hip-hop and stuff and really experimental stuff is where it's going, so.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe it'll leave a bit of a legacy there with something that he's done, but I liked it because how fucking challenging his music was. It was so so in your face and that, like, I don't think I'd ever heard anybody rap quite as heart on sleeve as that,
as aggressively as he did. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was a huge loss.
Absolutely, man. So that's a shame. So yeah, just still looking out for stuff. I mean, there's the label, what's the black metal label?
Extinctionist Records.
You did a video on.
Mm-hmm.
I like the stuff that they put out again, but the only, aside from a lot of track titles and stuff, there's a lot of, I like the sound of black metal, so antinatalist black metal doesn't pique my interest any more than regular black metal, I suppose, when it comes to sound-wise or message, but that might just be to do with kind of how I consume black metal compared to others. So yeah. But yeah, I mean, Maestro, he's still got, I still think he's got some of the little, you know, some of the real anthems. He was one of the guys that surely said a lot of that stuff first. My religion's misanthropy, first commandment, get a vasectomy. Sick.
Yeah, he just, you know, his stuff wasn't only great, but it was catchy. And I really just think, like, if he had stuck around, like, I just think he could have gone all the way with all of it. I just really think it was such it was great music. I miss him tremendously. Great guy.
He just vanished, right?
Just vanished, yeah, pretty much.
Still alive, as far as we know, though, which is
I do think he's still alive, you know, but just doesn't want to be found. Maybe that'll change in the future. I don't know. We'll have to see. But yeah, I love that. You, I mean, I love, well, I was going to say the word collecting again, but compiling, you know, I also do a lot of that. There's definitely some new stuff I'll have to send you, but I think that's great. I just, you know, it surprises me that more people aren't, you know, actively collecting and compiling this stuff. Cause there's so much good stuff out there now.
Yeah. But I guess you got nowhere to look for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's, you know, there's pretty big list of it on the A&I site, but
on there, yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on the future of antinatalism in art? Do you think that it will continue to influence and inspire artists of the future?
Yeah, I don't see why not. No, really. I mean, definitely. It's only going to grow, I think, you know, in our world of online communication or increased communication. I think it's only going to flourish. How fast or how slow, I don't know. But yeah, definitely.
I agree with you. I've asked you a little bit of this already, but I mean, how can people support your work? Can people donate to you? I will, of course, leave links to everywhere where you can be found and, you know, where things can be downloaded. But yeah, how can people best support what you do?
Just keep paying your taxes. I don't know, just leave a nice comment, seriously, or just the thumbs up or whatever. If somebody really wants a physical copy of something, then you can get in touch. Also, with regards to like any of the Ash Hunter stuff, moulinrouge.co.uk, and that's where stuff's available to purchase from, along with many other fine artists who I know.
Sweet. Awesome. Okay. Do you think antinatalism will continue to play a large role in your work moving forward?
I don't see how it, I mean, when we talk about large role, I assume, well, it can't not have a huge influence on me as a person and how I express myself. So there will definitely be certain things that, not necessarily I explicitly talk about, but that I explicitly don't have in there. You know, there's songs on my first record where I would say something like, you know, I wish to live a humble life, a family with kids and wife. Well, for instance.
I noticed that.
So when I played that live, to be honest, since I wrote it, I've just said, when I played it live, I've said, I wish to have a humble life with no family, kids or wife.
Because nice.
I say that anyway.
Well, it does speak to what you were saying about those albums earlier, that it's like this life that nobody gets to have kind of thing. It's that nostalgia for this impossibility kind of yeah. Idea. So I get it. I totally get it from that perspective completely.
So I think it'll definitely, I don't know how it couldn't kind of worm its way into my lyrics. You know, I mean, I'm not the most explicit lyricist generally, you know, obviously that was what was fun about doing No Child Left Behind, because it could be a bit more explicit, whereas I don't know, you know, who knows what I'll do next. I've just been making instrumental music recently, and that's something that I wanted to get back to, because sound is my favorite form of expression. I can express myself way better through sound than words.
What do you think of the antinatalist community as it exists today?
I think that the strongest voices are really positive ones, mostly in the antinatalist community. You know, I love Friendly Antinatalist. She's great. Mark, yourself. But the community, again, like I said earlier, I suppose it depends whether we're talking about a community or people who are hopping on message boards or Facebook groups to post anti, you know, throwing a baby off a cliff meme or something like that. You know, I don't know. But what's good is it's the good stuff that seems to be shining through, as far as I can tell, and the response in mainstream media. There's been a bunch of Guardian articles, things like that, or even Lawrence, obviously on Channel 4, you know, or even what's his name now, social experimentalist,
Danny Shine.
Yeah, even I don't agree with his methods, but I've seen the comments beneath that viral TikTok video, and a lot of them were really, you know, understanding.
Yeah.
So I was totally surprised by that. Like, so I think the kids are into it, man. That's what we need. Kids.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Okay.
What do you think antinatalists are doing right so far? And what do you think we're doing wrong?
So, I mean, everything right, you know, I suppose, I think it's just the good stuff, the discussions, the kind of measured activisms and writings. The hardest stuff that I find to swallow is provocative stuff, maybe like Danny Shine, for instance. Again, like, that's really appealing to some people. It's not for me necessarily, but right or wrong, that's to be seen, I guess. Or any discussions of violent solution, I just think is never going to transcend. Violence always met with resistance, I think, as I've said. And so those kind of things, that's the only place where I think it really falters, because it's optics are such a big part of a movement, as you know, so many elections have shown, especially in this country, that it's easier to be smeared than venerated these days. So it's just, I think, just about basically, it's not a case that people are doing something wrong, but, you know, there are some things that are more helpful than others, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
Who am I to judge necessarily?
Oh, yeah. What, in your opinion, does the future of antinatalism look like?
Bigger and better, baby. Yeah. like veganism was 10 years ago when people had never heard of it. I think it'll be something again that's just going to, people are going to get more interest in it. It does hit from a lot of angles, whether it is child-free, whether it's based on climate, you know, or those kind of arguments, environmental arguments. Right now, at this point in time, I think it hits such a strong chord with a lot of people, because before I was antinatalist, I was already saying, well, I wouldn't want to bring a child into this world anyway. What's so great about this world? And I think, you know, popular culture seems to be filled with nihilism at the moment. So, not that that's, you know, necessarily positive, but I think, you know, positive thought can come out of that with a more rationalized, you know, response or interpretation, if you will. So yeah, I think it's, I don't see, I think it's just going to, I think it's going to speed up like everything else. Moore's Law.
There you go. All right, Ash. Well, this has been excellent. I just wanted you to know that I wish you absolutely nothing but the best and the most success with everything that you do. And I love everything that you produce. I think you're so talented. And thank you so much for being our guest today on the Exploring Antinatalism podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Ash has 3 YouTube channels, and you should subscribe to them all. You can also follow Ash on Facebook, moulinrouge.co.uk, and Spotify. Contact Ash for physical copies, links to everything, and more below. Thank you for listening to the Exploring Antinatalism podcast. This has been Amanda Oldfan-Sukunik and Mark J. Maharaj. You can find us on the YouTube channels Forever Films and Question Mark, respectively. Keep up with my daily antinatalist news updates at Antinatal News on Twitter, now also a podcast. Please follow the Exploring Antinatalism podcast on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and email us at exploringantinatalism@gmail.com. The podcast can be listened to on the YouTube channel Exploring Antinatalism Podcast, as well as Buzzsprout, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, SoundCloud, RSS feed, and so many other platforms. Our website, www.exploringantinatalism.com, was designed by the amazing Visions Noirs. Please visit Visions Noirs at www.bionoir.com and find more of his links to more of his work below. Logo art by the incredible Life Sucks. Please visit his YouTube channel and subscribe. And if you would like to perhaps purchase one of the new Exploring Antinatalism t-shirts by Life Sucks, visit his Etsy page at www.etsy.com/shop/lifesuckspublishing. And also be sure to check out his brand new The ABCs of Antinatalism coloring book. It is a phenomenal work that I'm sure you'll enjoy. And proudly announcing, our new theme music has been graciously provided by I Doubt It. I Doubt It is an alum of the Exploring Antinatalism podcast, so please listen to his episode, episode 4, and visit and subscribe to his amazing YouTube channel. All the best, and bye for now.